Hello and happy new year, everyone. Welcome to Laser Focus. My name's Kyle Anderson. This is the deep dive pop culture podcast from Nerdist. This is our first episode of 2024. Very excited to have this returning champion on to talk to me about a thing that I'm very excited about. Say hello once again to Ty Gooden. Hi, Ty.
Hi, Kyle. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. and even happier because we have Doctor Who to talk about.
Yes.
We got four episodes in a six-week span, which was pretty good. That's a pretty good hit rate these days. Yeah, so we're, of course, going to be talking about the three, ostensibly the 60th anniversary specials, which were starring David Tennant and bringing back Catherine Tate, and then the Christmas special, which officially introduced Shurigatwa, even though he, spoilers, appears pretty extensively in the last of the David Tennant specials, which we will talk about, of course. Mm-hmm. It was interesting, like, thinking about them as, I mean, because obviously this is, like, ushering in a new era. Also, you know, because they're on Disney Plus now, so you have Disney money. Russell T. Davis is back, and it's been 15 years since he's been the showrunner. Things have changed. He has sort of changed as a writer in mm-hmm. terms of, like, you know, being more aware of the world being different. Because, you know, I don't know about you, but, like, recently when I've gone back and rewatched older RTD era shows, there's a lot of, like, stuff that I don't think would fly. There's a lot of, like, fat humor, you know, sizist humor, and you know, kind of just
not a lot of awareness about cultural diversity and things, you know, specifically with Martha and her run. There were a lot of things that happened there that I was like, are you aware that this person is Black?
And just stuff that is much more questionable to, you know, to treat the way that they have. And it seems initially, mm-hmm. like, right away, like, he is going out of his way to be like, I know times are different. Here's what we're doing now. He's not making a big deal out of it, but he is mm-hmm. also being like, I am aware that things are different, which is good. Yes. I think that was my biggest concern, is that it was just going to be old feeling. But he's a smart enough guy to know that, like, and he's made a lot of, like, culturally relevant drama in the intervening years. So, like, I think he gets that he needs to be much more aware of what he's putting out into the world, which is good, I think, overall.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think overall he does. I mean, of course, some things, I think specifically with, like, the first Christmas special, not Christmas special, the first anniversary special, with kind of some of the stuff about, you know, male presenting Time Lord, you know, wouldn't understand that you could just let it go. I mean, some of that stuff feels a bit heavy handed, but,
for,
you know,
sure, yeah.
I think too, we're always examining and looking at the show and enjoying the show from our American perspective. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it doesn't always line up with, you know, like, British and UK sensibilities. And so sometimes you may have to be a bit more on the nose with things, you know, with those folks there, as opposed to, you know, as opposed to what we may get here. And you also have so much of a younger audience coming in too. And people have to be mindful and cognizant of that. It's kind of the same thing I was saying earlier this year when I was having friends, you know, and we're conversating about Barbie and how they were saying, like, oh, it's very feminist 101 and, you know, very on the nose. This is not really that complicated. But I'm like, yes, but they're also younger girls that are watching a movie like Barbie, and you need to break their entryway into feminism in some kind of way. And I kind of feel like that's what Davies was doing with, you know, with the Star Beast, and, you know, kind of getting people to understand that everything doesn't exist in a binary. Mm-hmm. People don't exist in a binary. The Doctor as an entity doesn't exist as, you know, a binary, no matter how that, you know, how this particular character presents. So yeah, I think he, you know, like I said, it felt a little on the nose, you know, with some things or whatever, but but I think overall, I mean, especially with the way that he handled Rose's character, Rose Noble, and, you know, her introduction and, you know, talking about who she was as a, you know, as a trans teenager and the realities that she'd face and, you know, all of those things. Like, to me, and it just came, like, across like just natural, you know, it didn't feel like ham-fisted or forced in there or anything. No. It was just,
And that was the best stuff in the Star Beast, I think, because the Star Beast has to do a lot of heavy lifting in terms of, like, why does the Doctor look like this again? How can Donna remember mm-hmm. him and it be okay? And, like, just all that stuff that is essentially RTD righting his own wrongs, you know, like, because I forget if you and I have talked about it, but I've talked about it elsewhere and you've talked about it elsewhere and written about it, where like he really did Donna dirty. Like,
oh yeah,
the end of series four in 2008 is really not nice to her. Like,
yeah,
she has all this character growth that gets erased because of a tragic, you know, yeah, punch
and
ending.
It just completely took away her agency. Like, yeah, she had no choice.
Yes.
The doctor was just like, I'm doing this to you and there's nothing that you can do about it. It just, it felt so against his character. It just, I don't know. Ugh.
Yeah.
When I think about it, it just, it's just icky.
I know.
Especially with their relationship, because they were such, they felt like such equals and they had such a great friendship and a great partnership and stuff. And that just felt like a huge betrayal to the relationship that they had built up to that point.
Yeah, he doesn't even ask her. He just kind of does it.
He just does it.
And in fact, no, she goes, don't do this.
She's like begging him not to do it. Yeah. Yeah, and he does it anyway.
Yeah, that is really rough. And that's something that really hasn't aged well. And for me, a lot of the raison d'etre of doing the three Tenet specials was to be like, let's do a version of ostensibly the 10th Doctor, but it's the 14th Doctor. But he's different. He's very, you know, he is more open. He is a bit more in touch with his feelings. He is still like hurt, you know, but that's the whole point of his arc by the end of those three, is that he can let it go. Essentially, he can be happy. He can heal, which is something the 10th Doctor never really got to do. And also be like okay with not being quote unquote the Doctor anymore. That was a huge thing with the end of Tenet, and part of the reason that it really rubbed me the wrong way is that, like, you know, he's just like kicking and screaming the whole way. It's like that's not fair to the next Doctor to do that.
Right. The 14th Doctor was just so much healing. You know, and that was what I really, really liked about this particular, I think this incarnation of the Doctor came at the right time.
Yeah.
Especially when you look at everything that 12 and 13 went through with the Flux and, you know, with the whole Heaven Sent, Hell Bent, you know, arc there and stuff. I mean, the Doctor has been holding on to so much pain for hundreds, thousands of years. You think about everything that's happened to this one character since the beginning of the series, and the Doctor's never taken time. The Doctor doesn't go to therapy. You know, there's no time to really take and be able to release and kind of parse through those emotions and stuff. And so the 14th Doctor came to give the Doctor healing and release. And I mean, like, for me, that whole aspect of it resonated so much for me on a personal level, just with like grief that I experienced in the last couple of years of losing people you love and, you know, looking at things that are going on in the world, like the collective like grief and hardship that we've had to go through over the past few years. Look at how the world has changed since 2019. Yeah. And so we get to go on this journey with the Doctor where he gets to go back to probably one of the things that probably has bothered him the most, that relationship with Donna, that you have to kind of keep this distance away from someone that you love so much. And maybe this, you know, this huge questioning of, did I do the right thing? And is there any way for me to be able to fix it? And he gets a chance to go back and fix those things with her, give her those adventures, restore those relationships, and then also just like embrace and heal himself. Like the whole bi-generation concept, I know it, you know, rubs some people the wrong way, but I absolutely, absolutely loved it. Thought it was like brilliant.
Yeah. So, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot, and please, faithful listener, if you also subscribe to our YouTube channel, please expect a very long video from me about this in the future. But the bi-generation, I was very surprised to see. Okay, so let's peek behind the curtain here. Is it the curtain? Ty and I got screeners for the Star Beast and then not Wild Blue Yonder. I suspect it's because the CGI wasn't finished yet. Then we got the first part of the giggle, and we only got about 35 minutes, 38 minutes, something like that. And I was like, that's a short amount. And they said they were going to cut it off. They didn't lie to us. They didn't like lead us the wrong way. They said, we're not going to show you the ending, but it's a good 25 minutes that they just didn't show us because it has all the shooty stuff and the bi-generation, all that stuff. So once we finally got to that point when the actual episode was on, I was like, okay, here we go. And I was like, oh yeah, this makes sense. He's going to regenerate early and all this stuff. And then oop, there's two doctors, and it's like, that's a fun idea. What? Yeah. And it's something that hasn't been done before. And then as I'm watching it, I'm going, oh, there's a section of fandom that is going to absolutely hate this.
Yes.
But there, like, if you look at the entire history of Doctor Who, there's never really a quote unquote normal regeneration. We don't actually exactly know what that means. It's like you maybe have a handful, or not even a handful, like two or three in the entire time, every time the Doctor has regenerated or not, that is, you know, a typical regeneration. Like there's always right something the matter with it, and to the point where it's like there is no typical regeneration. So what is the deal? And bringing in somebody like the Celestial Toymaker, who can, break the laws of reality in a lot of ways, that makes a lot of mm-hmm sense. Like, hey, this is it a new a thing sense that can happen, and with that character, you can do things like that. And if you are like a Doctor Who dork like we are, you also know that way back in the 60s, they were thinking, well, maybe in the Celestial Toymaker episode, we can change the actor, and this would be an easy way to do it because he has such weird yeah outside space and time powers. They didn't end up doing that, but this like fulfills that in a fun way.
Right.
So anyway, all of that is to say, everybody calm down about the bi-generation. it's a fun idea. It also, why would you want to watch David Tennant die a second time? Do you know?
Again, like going back to what I was saying about the Doctor and healing and stuff, like that was a really great way to give the Doctor some healing. So like yeah, the 14th Doctor gets a chance to take rest, to have that family and yep have that connection that, you know, the Doctor has always been chasing. I mean, that's why we've had all these companions, right? That's why we've mm-hmm had all these travels. The Doctor's always been in search of stability and a foundation. And so that aspect of the Doctor, because I mean there's duality and, you know, in many parts and many facets in all of us, right? The Doctor's no different. So that aspect of the Doctor gets to lay down those burdens
mm-hmm
and really parse through those things and have that family and have that stability. It's not saying that the Doctor will never be, you know, the Doctor as we know this being to be again. There's a TARDIS there.
Mm-hmm.
The 14th Doctor is still clearly using it. Hello, Big Finish.
Yeah, right.
Can't wait to hear what you guys do with that. Like,
yeah,
go mine there for audio stories. But yeah, so I mean, it's not that the Doctor is no longer the Doctor anymore. The 14th Doctor is not the Doctor. They both of them are the Doctor. But now you have the 15th Doctor that can let go of some of that and release yeah that. It has this new lease of life to be able to go out and start fresh. Like, fans need that new lease. The show is on this new lease. Like, it just feeds further into this whole idea. Even with the next season being called season one. Like, I mean, we're really coming yeah into a new, fresh era. And it was such a smart, you know, smart way to be able to go into that.
Yeah. And I obviously want to talk kind of more in depth about each of the episodes individually, but I do want to talk yeah about, you know, like what we're talking about with the 14th Doctor and kind of being in pain still, but like being able to kind of, you know, cope a lot better than the Doctors have mm-hmm in the past. And then that leads to the 15th Doctor, who is so in touch with his emotions, but isn't ruled by them, mm-hmm, you know, that, which is something that I think a lot of people are concerned about when the Doctor is too quote unquote human. It's, you know, behaves too human-like, which is stupid, whatever. But, right, but there's that part in The Church on Ruby Road where, you know, he kind of goes, I'm adopted. I found that mm-hmm out recently. And just being able to say that kind of stuff is something that is very right refreshing for the Doctor to be able to do.
Instead of having to be secretive. You know,
that's one of my biggest problems.
Yeah. He was really open with Ruby.
Yeah. Very much. Jump. Yeah.
And that took me by surprise.
Me too.
I did not think, I thought it was going to be something that he would reveal later on. I'm like, oh, okay. Well, he's, you know, because of course, as the audience, we see the connection, you know, with the whole adoption thing with Ruby and stuff. But I thought he was going to reveal that later on. But I'm like, okay. So again, he's got that release. He's had that release. Now he mm-hmm feels the freedom to be able to be, you know, more open and honest. But like you said, like his emotions aren't ruling every decision he's making. He's still the Doctor and doing the things that the Doctor needs to do. But mm-hmm he can be honest about, yeah, this thing happened to me and it hurt me.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not necessarily okay, but I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
As time goes on, as adventures go on and stuff, I'll be able to find, like, this is my new normal that I'm trying to find now. And I'm off to the stars to find what exactly that means for me.
Yeah, and like thinking back, like that is one of my biggest problems with the character of the 13th Doctor is that she is so closed to any mm-hmm. kind of emotion or anything like that, and just doesn't tell anybody anything. Like I was thinking about this yesterday. I am pretty sure, even Yaz doesn't and didn't know anything about Tek Teun or any of that stuff, because all that happened when she was not around. Right. In flux and everything like that. And it's like, this is such a huge thing in this character's life. Right. And you don't tell anybody about it. You don't engage with it in any way.
This is your fam. You're calling these people your family and you won't say a word to them.
Yeah.
And they know you're suffering. They can see it. And you just refuse to reveal anything to them.
And even in the episode, Can You Hear Me, which is an entire episode about being able to talk about your feelings with your friends and family and and not feeling alone and all this stuff, she doesn't. Like even like Graham talks to her about the way he's feeling and she just kind of goes, uh-huh, yep.
Okay.
Like,
yeah.
And it's like, it's funny, I guess, a little bit for the Doctor, but there's no growth for the 13th Doctor. The ending needed to be... She needed to open up, I guess, a little bit as a character.
Something. She didn't have to flood him with her emotions, but open up and say something. Yeah.
And I know that Chris Chibnall had a specific, you know, vein that he was mining for with that character. And I just don't think it came across. I think it was in his head. And I think much like the Doctor, like it was too internal for it to really like resonate, I think, with most people, unless he explains it, which is like, oh, okay, now I see, you know, because you and I both went to Gallifrey One here in Los Angeles in February, and Chris Chibnall was one of the main guests, and he explained a lot of that stuff, and it's like, okay, mm-hmm. now I understand what you're talking about and what you were going for. I just don't think it came across.
Show me, don't tell me. Yeah,
because right. you're telling me on afterwards.
You're telling me on the back end. That's not helping at all.
Yeah.
Like you could have just show me in the episode.
By the way, how many... I'm talking to Ty Gooden here, who is somebody who has not only interviewed Jodie Whittaker, but also interviewed Shuti Gatwa recently.
I did. It was awesome. Oh my gosh. He's just an absolute delight. Like super, super sweet, super kind. A lot of times when you're doing interviews, you kind of really don't know what you're going to get, no matter how a person kind of comes across on screen, or they could be playing the most jovial character in the world. And then you can get in an interview with them and that's just not their natural personality.
Right.
And some people just don't like interviewing. Like I totally get that, because they're like, I'm an actor. I want to act. I don't want to sit on a junket and talk to people who are asking me, you know, different variations of the same question all day, which understandable. Yep. But I mean, he was definitely one of those people that you could tell he was like excited about it. He's amped about the show. He holds, you know, Russell T. Davies in super high regard. Mm. And he just has a love for like the fandom and this world and everything that's to come or whatever. And he was super engaged, like, you know, interacting with me, calling me by my first name, like, you know, kind of, you know, repeating, you know, the question back to you and asking a couple of questions of his own, like in the mix and stuff. It was really awesome. Like he's fantastic. And Millie Gibson is too. I got a chance to talk to her as well.
And where can people find these interviews that you've done?
They can find them at good old Nerdist.
Yeah. Nerdist.com/.com. Just look, search Doctor Who. That's the best way to do it.
Plenty of Doctor Who content there.
They were
really, really, both of them were really, really great. I would love to be able to chat with them together, because it seems like they both talked about how they have such a good rapport and they get on very well. And of course we see that in the Christmas special, because they are fantastic.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, I just wanted to kind of big up my friend here, but also direct people to your interviews. But yeah, so let's go into the individual episodes. So we start with the Star Beast, which, like I said before, has to do a lot of legwork to kind of get Donna back in the fold, essentially, without necessarily negating what happened, but also like reflecting on it and fixing it, because it was wrong. Like, you know, it wasn't just a kind of a lame story thing to do. If we're looking at it outside, it's like, okay, that's so easy. Like, why would she want to leave the TARDIS? Oh, she doesn't remember anything. But it's like, it's unduly cruel to that character who has come a long way. So we have all that stuff. We have, as you mentioned, Rose Noble, which is, you know, to there's no, you know, like kind of beating around the bush here. This is a time when trans people are under attack, especially in the UK. And to have a character just be trans on television, especially for new viewers and younger viewers, I think is so important and so good. And like, yes, the last bit is very ham-fisted, where it's like, a male presenting Time Lord wouldn't really, that's on the nose a bit too much. That smacks of an older guy trying to be inclusive.
Does. Yeah.
But the fact that she's there is awesome. The fact that like, they actually give Donna and Sylvia, her mother, that kind of conversation about, am I saying the right things? And she's like, you know, I know it's tough, but you know, all you got to do is make an effort and like all that. It was so nice to see.
It was lovely to see, especially with Sylvia, you know, being the, because of course, I mean, we could see Donna, a person who has traveled in the TARDIS, and seen aliens and stuff. Of course, she would be, you know, a pretty open-minded person, you would imagine, or whatever. But her mom, not so much, you know, of an older generation. Yeah. Again, a British woman. But her being so concerned and so loving of like, I just want to, you know, even when she slips up, she immediately corrects herself. And she's just like, I just want to do and say the right thing. I want to tell her that she's beautiful. I want to affirm her and stuff. I mean, and that's so vital and important to see, because you're seeing so many more parents starting to be supportive, especially parents of like, millennial generation, like, you know, our generation and stuff. And so us trying to teach, you know, and I'm saying that as a person who has a queer child myself or whatever, and trying to teach older generations in my family, getting them to understand. And I've seen a lot of that with them, where it's like, you know, I don't always get it right. I don't know the questions to ask or anything like that. And I'm like, you know, you won't always get it right. It's a learning process. So I love that they did that with Sylvia. And Rose is brilliant and sweet. Like, I just want to hug her. She's adorable.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and she's coming back. We see in the trailer for the full season, she's going to be in it at least for one episode. So that's awesome. So yeah,
so happy. I want to see her and Shmi. I was like, I need to see them two together. Right? I'm excited about Ruby, and I think those two are going to make a magical team. But I was like, man, it would have been really awesome to see like Rose in the TARDIS with Shmi's 15th Doctor. But I'm like, at least we get them together at UNIT. It looks like they're at UNIT anyway.
Yeah, they're at UNIT for sure. Yeah. And speaking of UNIT, we get Shirley. I forget the character's last name, but the...
Brigman, I think.
Yes, that sounds right.
Bingham, Brigman, one of those.
Who is, you know, one of the, I don't know, leaders of UNIT? I don't know. Like, nobody really is. It's not the Brigadier anymore. They're just kind of amorphous, but... And that is somebody who is differently abled, who is just and like they obviously don't ignore it. That's part of who she is as a character. And they also kind of that, you know, bigoted minded people get, you know, shown as part of the evil like Toymaker virus and the Giggle and everything like that. And it's like that's again, he's not being Russell T. Davis, but the show is not steering away from these conversations, which again I think is really great. But she's a really good character. She and Tennant spark off each other so well.
They do.
I love that whole scene when he's talking to her in like the little alleyway. It's awesome. That was one of my favorite scenes in that episode, because
it is. It's great, and I love it when she comes back and she can fire weapons from her wheelchair. I'm like, that is so awesome.
Yeah, totally. That was really good.
Love it.
But I think the really cool thing about, or one of the cool things about this, is that this is an adaptation of a comic strip from the 70s, which is like a direct, you know, there was one called The Star Beast by Pat Mills and Dave Gibbons. And it was a Tom Baker era story, and it has Beep the Meep in it and everything like that. And I was just like, that is awesome. Like, there are so many really weird little stories that you can use from old spinoff material. I thought that was a really cool way to be like, Doctor Who's back, but it's also celebrating 60 years of existence, not just on television, but in the pages stuff.
Great way to tie into the history and honor the legacy and stuff. And I love that all of them got credited as well.
Me too. Me you know, too.
For this episode. And Beep the Meep was just, I'm like, come on, BBC, where are the toys at? I need the Beep the Meep plushie.
Well, yeah. Especially now that there's Disney money involved. Like, you don't think they want to merchandise this stuff? Like, come on. I mean, the goblins also, for that matter. A little pirate goblin? Get out of here. Why wouldn't I want that?
Yes, press a button and make it sing.
Yeah.
That goblin song.
And Miriam Margoyles, or Margulies, I don't actually know how you say her name, but as the voice of the Meep was pretty spot on, because she is awesome. So meek at the beginning. And then once it's realized that she's evil, or they are evil, Meep is evil, it was hilarious. It's just like, you know, like the eyes turn.
Right, the mean. Eyes turn in. Oh, yeah, so the teeth look all sharp and stuff. I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. And one of the most hateful characters, like, I think ever, too. Like, just such a nasty.
I'm like, oh my gosh, character. You're just mean for the sake of being mean. It's like, I'm going to blow up the city and use it as fuel for my ship.
Like, I love it. Yeah. So, but I will say that I think that might be, as much as I like that parts of that episode and a lot of the episode, and it mostly has to do with seeing Tennant again and seeing how 10 or 14, I guess, is different from 10. I kind of think that ultimately is my least favorite of the three. Like, I think they go in ascending order for me. I think the Giggle's my favorite, and Wild Blue Yonder is second favorite, and this one third favorite. I still like them all quite a bit, but which is good. I actually think, like, if they just started and the Star Beast was the best one, it would have been a letdown. But the fact that
it built up and continued to get better.
Yeah. I thought that was really good. But like I said, there's a lot of, like, shoe leather that has to be done in the Star Beast. Yeah. And it feels like the first part of a RTD season. Like, he has to do so much work to reestablish people. Yeah. Sean Temple, is that the character's name?
Donna's husband.
Yeah. Sean. Yeah. Like, you have to kind of reestablish him, and he's like, and then talk about why they don't have the money anymore. Like, all that stuff that, like,
there were so many questions that you had to answer. Cause that was when I initially saw the trailer, the first thing I was thinking was like, well, isn't Donna rich?
Yeah, don't they have millions of pounds? Yeah.
Millions of dollars. I was like, she appears to be standing in a normal house and living a very normal life. I'm like, I thought she would have, like, had a fashion empire or something ridiculous like that by now. But
yeah,
she's rich, she can do what she want to do.
And then she's gotten sacked again from whatever job she was doing, and it's just like,
poor Donna. And her destroying the console with her cup of coffee is just,
yeah,
of course you would.
Yeah, of course.
Of course you would.
Of course. Oh, speaking of, what do you think of the new TARDIS interior?
It's gorgeous.
It's gorgeous.
When he opened up the doors and he, like, you see it. At first I was like, it's just so bland. It's like all white and stuff. And, like, I was enjoying him running up and down the ramps and everything, you know. But then it started kind of like getting those flashes of color that come across. And I was like, oh, this is pretty. I'm like, they gotta keep this.
Yeah.
It looks otherworldly. Like, yeah, it looks like alien and, you know, alien and foreign in that kind of way. Like, it's gorgeous.
I love a huge TARDIS. Like, that is like, Matt Smith's first TARDIS is really big, or, you know, interior. It has multiple gangways and, like, corridors, you know, or ramps to different hallways and stuff like that. That's what I wanted continually. And I think, like, his second and then Capaldi's TARDIS, it's got different levels and stuff, but it felt a little bit smaller to me. And then I never got a good sense of Jodie's TARDIS's, like, dimensions. It just never, they never shot it in a way that made
it seem, like, really confined. Yeah. Like, it seems super small on the inside.
Yeah. And so seeing this and seeing that there's all those different levels and different, you know, portholes to different parts of the TARDIS that I'm sure we're never going to see, but, like, knowing that that's there is really cool.
It was awesome.
And also knowing that they built, like, and that, like, it's permanent, essentially. Like, this is the TARDIS. Like, we're keeping this. It's that and the unit set. They're like, we're going to get our money out of these sets because they've spent
that
money on them.
They've
and they're
spent
really
a
big.
Lot of money on
them. Which is great. So it's like, yeah, let's spend more time in unit. Let's spend more time in the TARDIS. Like, I just think that's awesome. So,
yeah. I love the screwdriver, too.
The screwdriver. Divers. Yeah.
Yeah. He was doing some cool stuff with that thing. I was like,
yeah.
I love it.
Like, that is some, I'm sure people are annoyed about that too, but
yeah,
because it can create barriers and stuff. Like it's definitely more versatile than it had been in the past.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, y'all got Disney money for sure. Ooh. When I saw those barriers come up, I was like, oh
yeah,
y'all are doing something with the screwdriver. Why wouldn't it be able to do that? Yeah. Like, that's my whole thing is when people get upset about like little aspects like that, because it's a change or something. I'm like, I mean, the show is literally all about change.
Yeah.
He's constantly tinkering with it. It's constantly upgrading itself and changing itself and, you know, like in a sense, kind of regenerating itself in a way, just like the Doctor is. So why wouldn't it be able to develop new, you know, new capabilities and more and be more technologically advanced?
Yeah.
Like, it's a sonic screwdriver. It should do more than just open a lock.
Yeah.
Or unravel a rope.
And it has in the past, like, you know, like it's essentially a magic wand in a lot of ways. And like, mm-hmm. Let's make it more kind of technologically advanced. Like, I don't think there's a problem with that. Do you remember when people lost their dang minds because of the 12th Doctor's sonic sunglasses? Do you remember?
Oh my God, yes.
Hated that.
Hated those glasses.
And who cares? Like, that was my big thing. Like, he gets to boop and see stuff. Like, how is that different than Matt Smith, like, scanning something and looking at it like it's a tricorder? Like, it doesn't.
It's literally the same thing.
The same.
Except for it looks a little bit more incognito because he's not having to wield out a literal screwdriver and point it at something.
Yeah. And he also never really.
Out of his glasses.
I never loved the 12th Doctor sonic screwdriver. It was like, I don't know, too asymmetrical for me or something like that.
Yeah.
It was a little weird.
I have a few of them. I don't have his.
I have his. I don't have the 10th Doctor, which is a weird one to not have, but.
No, I don't. I have the 11th Doctors.
Yeah.
And have 13th.
Yeah. 13th.
Maybe the
9th
Doctors. 13th is cool. Yeah. Was not a big fan of the TARDIS interior. Definitely was a fan of that sonic screwdriver.
Yeah. And I like the DIY aspect of it. Mm-hmm. I always wanted I'm a huge Third Doctor fan, but the Third Doctor sonic screwdriver, which has like the black like stripes going up it, which is just like it's so weird, and it's really big. Like, big fan of that. Anyway, was there anything else you wanted to say with the Star Beast? What any other thoughts that or parts of it that we missed talking about?
No, besides, I just love it. And I think it sets up the surely coming unit series.
It has to. Completely agree. So then we move on to the Wild Blue Yonder, which again, we didn't get screeners for that one. So that was definitely the biggest question mark of the three. And it was. It's interesting because I know there's only three episodes with the 14th Doctor and Donna by extension. So you kind of go like, oh, this is a really like small episode for it to be a special, you know, like is an argument to have. The more I've watched it, the more I really like it. And I like the fact that it's just the two of them and the villain is the kind of like anti-evil versions of themselves, like the not good versions of them and who, you know, how much they've been copied and things like that. And the kind of body horror aspect I think is really interesting too. And just the sparseness of that ship and, you know, so I came down on really, really enjoying, Wild Blue Yonder, and the performances especially.
Yeah, I mean, it gave you a chance to really get to, even though we knew we weren't going to spend a lot of time with him, it gave you a chance to really get to know them and get a sense of where the Doctor is right now. But more importantly, like where Donna is and how she's still like at her core the same, but she's also, you know, Donna's also stepped up and changed a whole lot or whatever. And I mean, all of that was locked away in her was still there. I like Yonder. I thought it was fun.
Yeah, I thought there's a lot of really cool stuff, you know, like the idea of the slow countdown, and like for whatever reason the know things from the edge of the universe can't figure out slow, so they just kind of go ignore it, which is fascinating, and also the fact that the Doctor can't stop thinking fast, and that's kind of like that's the biggest issue. It's like all he has to do is slow down, which has always been the Doctor's problem. The Doctor being forced to stay put is like their least favorite thing in the world.
But again, it's all back, like the whole purpose of the 14th Doctor is facing your past, dealing with your like core issues, dealing with your core wounds and all of that. And that plays right into it because there's no, you know, I mean, we get more of that in The Giggle, you know, specifically when he talks to Donna about just like, what am I without the toys?
Right.
Who am I without the sonic screwdriver and the TARDIS and adventures and running and doing all of those things? And it was specifically that episode that made him kind of hold a mirror up to himself and be like, you know, who am I without these things? How do I problem solve? How do I get through, you know, how do I get through things? And even then he still, you know, makes a, you know, quick snap in judgment that has bigger consequences that end up, you know, coming on behind. And then you have to deal with the consequences of those things and just the weight that, you know, that character must feel of having to carry that on their shoulders all the time.
Yeah. And I also like that, like, it isn't just that he looks like the 10th Doctor and is contending with all the stuff from that era. Like, they are talking about stuff that just happened in terms of the Doctor's life. So, like, in the Star Beast, he talks about, like, there was this thing called the Flux and it was terrible and I ruined, like, you know, millions of trillions of people died and it was all my fault kind of thing. Even though that's not entirely true, that's still like, that's what he feels about that.
That's his perspective.
Yeah. We know the Doctor is very capable of self-loathing and guilt. So there was that. And then you get in this one, even though he thinks he's talking to real Donna, he's actually talking to imposter Donna, but where she goes, where are you from? And he says, you know, I'm from Gallifrey. And she goes, no, you aren't, because that is something we just learned. We, the audience, but that the Doctor now knows about themselves is that, they were not from Gallifrey. They came from elsewhere and don't know anything about where they came from. I have to believe that that aspect of, I think Russell T. Davis either talked to Chris Chibnall or paid very close attention to what Chibnall was doing when he knew he was going to take over again and went, I'm going to do that. I'm going to have that. I don't think Ruby Sunday would be a foundling if there wasn't that tie-in to the character. Because that's how you do thematic storytelling. You find parallels and you talk about them. But I loved that scene where he kind of like, oh, and then when he finally, when they get back together, the real versions, and he's like, is that true? And she goes, no, I forgot it. And you know that she didn't, and she just doesn't want to make him talk about it. Loved it. I thought it was great. And
we also get Mavity.
Oh yeah. I forgot about Mavity.
I don't know why it's so stupid.
It's so stupid.
That's what we need.
Yeah.
Like for all the, you know, like the heaviness of the Doctor and embracing, you know, embracing themselves and all the stuff like that. Like that's what I'm enjoying about what I've enjoyed about these recent episodes and what I'm looking forward to in the future too. It's just like that freshness and fun and silliness or whatever. And like, I mean, Doctor, like imposter versions of the Doctor and Donna with big eyes, googly eyes, hanging limbs, and the whole idea of them like running into a tree and hitting Sir Isaac Newton. Well, he wasn't Sir yet, but Isaac Newton and hit with an apple and him misunderstanding it as Mavity. And now if forever in the Doctor Who universe, it'll be known as Mavity instead of Gravity, because they're just out here being ridiculous.
Yeah.
Thanks to Donna.
And in every episode after that, they say Mavity at least once. And it's just like,
he said it in the Christmas special. And I just giggled so much. This is so stupid.
It's very funny. And I also like that there's a moment in Wild Blue Yonder. So that's how we know that they messed it up, is he goes Mavity, and then there's the opening credits, and then at some point they go, we've got air, we've got Mavity, you know, like all that stuff, which is really funny.
Right.
And then later in the episode the Doctor says Gravity and she goes, what? And he goes, Mavity. Which is, so he knows, but he's like, I'll deal with this later. There's no reason for it not to be Mavity at the moment.
Sure, let's let it be Mavity.
I also really like the fact that they're at the edge of the universe. He's worried about the edge of the universe because it's like the laws of physics and everything are kind of blurred. They start to fade. Because what is outside the universe? Like all known existence, what's outside of that? Like, that's a creepy idea. That is literally the wild blue yonder of the thing. And then he evokes a superstition, and then he's like, I shouldn't have done that, that's bad. And then that is ostensibly what allows the toy maker to come back. I thought that was a really cool idea, because
I did too. It's a great horror concept.
It's a great horror concept. And that like leads into eventually what happens in the Christmas special, which is like the laws, like fantasy and magic are now kind of blurred in terms of, you know, because Doctor Who is never really a sci-fi show. It's a science fantasy show. You can kind of hide behind the fact that you want it to be a sci-fi show, but it's not. It's sure. not Star Trek. You know what I mean? It's right. a fantasy. And I like that they're just like, yeah, these are just going to be like goblins that eat people in the sky. Like, it's just like, there's no, we have no idea where they come from. Are they aliens? It doesn't matter. So I'm big into that concept of like, let's just play with what the show is. There's time travel, but there's also weird magic-y fantasy stuff and also aliens. And it's just like, why not? It's Doctor Who.
Yes. Let it all coexist at once.
Yeah. Let it all hang out. That's only if you watch the show after midnight. but yeah, I thought Wild Blue Yonder was really fun and a really cool middle episode, because again, and also you want to see those two actors spend as much time together as you can if you're going to bring them right. back, because that is what everybody loves about series four, even though I think a lot of the there's some bangers in series four, like you got the library two-parter, you got Midnight, you got Turn Left, like those are all excellent episodes, well written, well acted, well everything. But there's also a lot of meh episodes and kind of not good episodes, like the Doctor's Daughter or the Sontaran. I like the Sontaran two-parter more than most people, but it's not amazing. Mm-hmm. It's just,
yeah, I think it's the Doctor's Daughter is definitely a episode. Yeah. It's their chemistry that
carries
the whole thing through.
So you want them to spend as much time as those characters as together without much else going on, and you know, they're great. And and the fact that they are both the bad guys and the good guys in that one is, I thought, was just really fun. And then we get to see Wilf at the end of that episode. And that was sadly the last thing that Bernard Cribbins shot. He was meant to come back and shoot the next one, but he passed away in between episodes. So that's why you only see him.
You can tell because you see him getting a TARDIS at the very end, you know?
Yeah. And
I'm like, oh, man.
You see him for a second in the giggle, but then he's just kind of not there. And then they just say that he's off. And that's like, again, like the fairy tale fantasy aspect of it. I just want Wilf to be alive forever. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's no reason to like spend so much time being like, because this actor died, then we have to talk about how the character died and everything like that. However, Shooty does, or you know, the 15th Doctor does tell the 14th Doctor that Sarah Jane's not there anymore. And that's like, oh, that was a tough.
Was a heartbreaker.
That was a heartbreaker.
Yeah.
It's like, it reminds me of that in series.
I just assumed she would stay alive.
Yeah.
In that universe. You know, I mean, nobody had ever said anything different.
Right.
So I assume she was still, even though we hadn't seen her, of course. I mean, there are so many companions that we haven't seen in a while, or some that we haven't seen since they left and we may never see again. But yeah, when he said that, I was like, oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
And it was heavy.
It was heavy. And it reminded me of that scene in, is it The Husband or the Wedding of Riversong, or one of those ones, one of the Matt Smith series six episodes where he's running, you know, he doesn't want to contend with the reality of what's going on or whatever. And then he's like, I'm going to go see my friend, the Brigadier. And then whoever at UNIT's like, oh, he died. The Brigadier's not alive anymore, which is, you know, the actor had passed away. And then that's the moment that makes him go, time comes for us all, essentially, or whatever. It's those kind of moments that really, you know, hit, even if you're not like the world's hugest Doctor Who fan. If you've watched the David Tennant years, you know who Sarah Jane is, you know, like, and so that was a moment that, again, we're talking about the giggle now, but like they're not shying away from the history, even though it's a new era starting with ostensibly season one again. Like, it still all happened. It's just not going to be.
But important. It's doing more than just like, oh, you know, Easter egg. Yeah. And I mean, we all like Easter eggs. I mean, they're fun and stuff, right? But I mean, there's a way to be able to honor
Easter eggs. But
there's a way to be able to honor the past without necessarily making everything into some kind of, you know, some kind of Easter egg. Like those tidbits right there let you know that this is, you know, an ongoing story and they're not going to ignore the legacy of the of the series. Like, it feels fresh. It feels like a new thing and stuff, but it still has the same foundation and like still has the same bones.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's somebody who's making the show who understands not just the show inside and out, but also television inside and out. So it's like, what do you include and what do you leave out? And, you know, it's there for us who like it. And it's, if you don't care or haven't seen it before, then that's something you go, oh, what is that? And then you can look that up later. It's not, doesn't change your enjoyment of the show. So let's talk about The Giggle, which, this is a big episode. It has a lot going on. Not only does it bring back a 1960s villain, who only appeared one time and has some, in, as depicted in the episode or in the 60s, some questionable racial content. The words celestial and kind of panic about Asian people was synonymous at the time, and kind of using Asian mysticism as being like, ooh, whatever.
That was a choice.
Yeah. So you have Michael Goff effectively wearing, I won't say he's wearing yellow face because I don't believe he actually is, but he is dressed in Chinese garb and kind of like assaying that sort of, it's not Marco Polo, which doesn't exist anymore. It's all completely gone. But that's a lot of white people in yellow face, that one. Or like the Talons of Wang Chiang, which is all just, oof. Those are icky episodes to watch nowadays.
Yeah.
The Celestial Toymaker is not, although they are animating it, so we'll see how that goes. But half of that episode or half of that story doesn't exist anymore. And it's not a great episode, but it has a really cool idea, which is this kind of god that only cares about games. Can do whatever he wants, but must play by the rules of play, which is a really, I think, a neat idea. And then getting Neil Patrick Harris to play the toy maker and doing an outrageous German accent, but on purpose. He's not doing a bad German accent as the character. The character is doing a bad German accent.
The minute he opens his mouth, I'm like, he is the most ridiculous person.
Yeah, it's so funny. Seen on TV in a long time. It's so funny. And you,
that was great casting choice, which I wasn't really like, I wasn't super sure about it at first. Like, I like Neil Patrick Harris. I think he's fine or whatever, but he was fun to watch.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And he just has the, like, the air of like he plays a good villain. The few times he's gotten to be like a villain, I think he does a really good job at that. But so we have Stooky Bill, right? That's the name of the puppet. That was a thing I knew nothing about. And you wrote a whole history of Stooky Bill, which again you can find on nerdist.com. But I thought that was cool. At first I was just like, what is this? And then like, oh, it's real. It's a real thing.
Yeah. The minute that popped up, I knew what it was because I'm a history nerd. So
wow, yeah. I didn't know it at all.
I was like, oh my gosh. I was like, they're actually including that. And I was really, when I saw the trailer and I saw like the little snippet of Stooky Bill in there, I'm like, I'm wondering how they're going to take that and like weave it into, because I knew it was, you know, a huge part of television history and stuff, but I didn't know if they would have John Baird in there or, you know, how they would be able to weave it in there. But he actually did a really, you know, a really cool job of weaving that in, like using an image and hiding it behind all of the images that we've ever seen on any screen throughout the existence of, you know, screens in this format or whatever. It's like, that is wild. Also kind of scary.
Very. Yeah, absolutely. Well, also the idea that we need a puppet because if a human stands under these lights, they will catch on fire.
They'll catch on fire.
Like,
which like was real.
Yeah,
that's why they used the puppet. Like in reality, the lights were so hot because it was such a new, like, you know, concept of technology or whatever, that they were afraid someone would literally catch on fire or that their skin at very least would get like severely burned.
Yeah. And then the giggle itself is just, you know, like, which is in there. It's the virus of sound and all this stuff. But what I think is really cool is that, what is Russell T. David? What did I just say? He knows a lot. Television. He knows television.
Television.
And television is important to him in the concept, in, you know, as just part of daily life. Like, you know, even as far back as series one, watching telly on a Sunday afternoon is an important, like, British institution, essentially. So, like, that's always something in the back of his mind when he's writing stuff. It's like, that's how, you know, information is conveyed these days, is television, like all the stuff. So he's really keyed into that. And I think using that again as the third of the three 60th anniversary specials about a show that has been on for such a long time is itself a television institution. and a British institution. I just thought that was like, he's playing with a lot of fun, you know, like referential bits that don't, it's not just like, this was on television and so is Doctor. Like he's not outwardly about it, but it's like, that's cool. That's right. It's a neat thing if you know about it or think about it a little bit.
Yeah, he tends to play with TV a lot too. It's just like with the Idiot's Lantern.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, he did that same thing too, where a bunch of people are gathered around the television to watch the largest event ever, the coronation of the queen. And so, of course, if you're going to be an alien and you want to be able to, you know, snatch people's essence or souls or whatever, how else would you do it? Do it on a day where every single person in you know, every single British person is going to be sitting in front of a TV.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, which is so funny to me too, because like, we know, because we live in the future, that... archiving television is now like a thing people do, you know, selling Blu-rays and DVDs of TV shows. But at the time they thought it was they being the people who made the TV thought it was just an ephemeral thing. And so that's why, that's where wiping came in. Like they wiped the tapes, and that's why so many Doctor Who episodes were, gone and are continued to be gone, is because they just wiped the tapes and didn't think twice about it. There's a possibly apocryphal story, so I don't want to say I may be getting it wrong, and the story itself might not be real, but I do want to share it, which is that at a certain point it came time for Monty Python's Flying Circus to be wiped, and somebody at the BBC like told, I think it was Terry Jones, that was the case, and so he went to the BBC and stole the tapes, and then in the... whatever the 80s or whatever, when BBC Gold or something like that wanted to show them again, they couldn't find the tapes, and so then he had to license them back to the BBC to be like, I suppose you're looking for these. But again, that might not be a true story. I hope it's true. I want it to be
that
true.
Is very, very chaotic good.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
I mean, because it's like you spend years and years making a show and then they just wipe it. And it's like there's nothing. I mean, we're seeing that nowadays with stuff on Max.
Physical
like
media matters.
Physical media matters. Physical.
Yeah, you've been saying that and championing that for a long time. And I totally, not that I didn't agree with you before, but I increasingly agree with your sentiment on that.
Yeah.
To the point now that I'm starting to kind of build my own collection of Blu-ray and DVD and stuff, because I mean, when you have it physical in your hand, can't get rid of it.
Yeah. And like, and it's just that simple, folks. Like if you really love a piece of media, get it physically so that you have it, because you know, even something as simple as like the internet goes down, you can't watch it, or you can't read your Kindle, or, you know, unless you have it downloaded or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, even a download, you know, like there could be a power surge and it wipes your hard drive. You don't have it anymore. Things you have purchased digitally can be removed from your library if whatever platform loses the license to it and stuff. It's that kind of thing. Like, so anyway, I'm not saying spend all your money on these things, but look at the things that are really important to you. Doctor Who is important to me. I want to own it all physically. Like, you know, Mystery Science Theater, like stuff like that. Not that that's hard to watch. You can watch it anywhere. Basically, there's Tubi channels.
But what happens when the day comes that you can't?
Exactly. So,
yeah.
And films too. Like, you know, there are people out there who take the time to archive films properly, but then there's also people who are in charge of certain current studios and streaming services who don't care about the actual individual products. They only care about the catalog that they can, that they can sell or remove things from if it, you know, saves them some money. So anyway, that's a soapbox that I will be on forever. These things matter, even if you think that they're stupid and not important. It's like, you know, local television commercials. We should still have records of these types of things too. Like these are all, these were broadcast things that we should at least know.
It's a part of our cultural history.
Yeah, exactly.
Like it's more than just, you know, it's more than just like a pinpoint in pop culture or, you know, just a random thing that was on TV. Like it's a way of documenting our history. commercials, they reflect, you know, the time period that they came out in. Yep. They reflect what the world was like, you know, during that time. And if you don't have those things documented, I mean, of course, we have YouTube now where you can go back and watch that 80s McDonald's commercial or whatever it is that you want to do. But I mean, the fact is that someone cared enough to actually save that media.
Yep.
Had they not, you know, you wouldn't be able to have that, you know, that nostalgic moment or get that snapshot back in time or see how far, you know, commercial making, TV making, filmmaking has been able to progress.
And that's, you know, a lot of that is the reason we have even some of the Doctor Who episodes that we have is that people, you know, because part of the whole thing is that like they would send tapes or film reels to different countries under the assumption that after the license wore off that they were meant to throw it away or wipe it or whatever. And a lot of them didn't. So that's how like some stuff was found in like African countries, I think. And then also like Hong Kong and just places, you know, in cupboards, essentially, like we just didn't throw this away and now we have it again.
Right.
But then there's also all those people who, you know, the episodes that are still missing, we have the off air audio from them because kids at the time with their early tape recorders would tape the audio from a TV show that they liked because it was never going to be broadcast again. And they wanted to be able to relive it.
Listen to it again. Yeah.
And so based on that, they put out audiobooks with linking narration of just the audio. And then that's what they use as the basis for the animations that they've made. And they're, you know, slowly but surely whittling down the number of quote unquote fully missing episodes, because now there are tons of animation of these stories that are really important to the history of Doctor Who that are now animated again. So I'm just such a huge proponent of that, you know, archiving. And like, you know, obviously they couldn't have known in the early 70s that this show was going to go on for another 50 years, but fact is it did, and we deserve to have as much of it as possible. Not just Doctor Who, any show deserves to exist somewhere.
Yeah.
For anybody to watch if they want to. Maybe not the whatever that show was called. There was literally a live action minstrel show on BBC, maybe ITV, I forget which, until the late 70s. So that one can just go. Well, no, keep it.
Yeah.
Keep it so that we know it existed.
I was going to say, sometimes you need to keep it. You need to keep that stuff. It existed and know that.
We don't need to put that one out on DVD. That was my whole point of that. We don't need to have that one. Anyway, so that's a diatribe about physical media and everything like that. But as it pertains to the giggle, I think that like making it about television and how everybody watches TV, everybody has a screen in front of their face at all times. And so that infects people with this virus. And what does the virus do? It doesn't like, it makes them think they're right, which is actually what the internet does.
Yeah.
It's brilliant. So
it does not make you physically sick. It literally just amplifies all of the nastiness that exists inside of the collective human race. Yeah.
I love
it. And a lot of that nastiness stems from everybody thinking that their opinion or their way is fact. And it's not.
No. And the scene where, like, to demonstrate it, Kate takes her little, like, you know, buffer armband off, Kate Stewart, played by Gemma Redgrave. I love Kate Stewart so much. She's one of my favorite characters.
Me too. She's great.
I'm glad she's going to come back, and she offers Donna a job, and she takes it. Whether we see Donna at UNIT, I just like knowing that Donna is going to work at UNIT. I think
that's working at UNIT.
I love it. Also, we'll talk about Mel in a second, but I do want to talk about this scene with Kate. And she is vile. Like, she says some really hateful things.
She does. Yeah.
And they kind of just, and afterwards when they put it back, she goes, "Oh my God, I'm so sorry." And, you know, Shirley's like, "It's completely fine." But it's also like, no, you said like, it's just like knowing that that's the way everybody seems to be.
Right.
Thinking they're right all the time, not thinking about somebody else's emotions and kind of feelings on the matter, but also like knowing that that is shameful to say these things. She's not just, "Oh, what a terrible thing I said all these things." Like, she is ashamed she said these things because she didn't at the moment take into account the other person's feelings at all. She was, and there's a lot of like fear behind it too. She's like, "No, what is," you know, like panic too. Like, you think you're right because you think everyone else is out to get you. I thought it was such a, like, without saying these things outright, you can kind of just watch that and go, "That's just how people are now." Like, that's just how people are on the internet.
It is. Yeah.
what an insightful and really upsetting way, you know, like point about society in which we live. Of course, we live in a society. Yeah. What did you think? What did you think of all that stuff? Like,
oh my gosh, it was so spot on. So yeah. On the nose again. Like, I mean, everybody has a screen in front of them. So mm-hmm. if there were going to ever be a way that you were going to, you know, mentally infect the masses, you would do it, you know, through the screens. And I mean, just the people fighting in the street and stuff, like
yeah,
all of that. Like it literally was like, they took like Twitter mm-hmm. or X or whatever you want to call it. It was like, they took it and just like brought it to life and like put it, like put yeah. it onto the streets. Yeah. All of the vileness, all of the nastiness and stuff. And literally like that was going to be the collapse of humanity. Like it goes back into that same like old age thing, whether it's this, whether it's, you know, zombies, no matter what it is, like humanity is always its own worst enemy mm-hmm. because of a lack of empathy
mm-hmm.
or a lack of, you know, understanding or a lack of tolerance for anything else outside of what people kind of see in their own realm and their own sphere.
Yeah. And it is all based in fear. Like, you know, like mm-hmm. I am afraid of this person who isn't me, essentially.
Yeah. Or yeah, who and doesn't fear think... rules so yeah. much evil. Like it, I mean, it truly is the root of so much evil in the world. It's just people not understanding something and not being willing to step outside again of their box.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're afraid of what's outside of those boundaries that they've been put in, whether they were put into those boundaries, you know, by birth or by circumstance or, you know, whatever. They're just afraid to step outside of it because they're afraid of what they're going to find.
Yeah.
And I mean, also a fear of just realizing that something that you accepted to be, you know, fact or truth, or like the limitations that you put, you know, again, going back to kind of like the idea of like a binary and stuff like that, something that you've always accepted to be true and you've been kind of groomed throughout your life from childhood mm-hmm. to, you know, see things exist in a certain way, like realizing that that's not the case. The fear of that security that you have in there completely crumbling down, like that terrifies people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like you said, it's the root of all evil or whatever. Like I think, and money of course is, but so much of, you know, what we're seeing in the world, you know, we're not going to get super political, but like people are just afraid of anybody who isn't them. And the internet has really given mm-hmm. voice to not listening to other people, just giving yourself a, you know, an echo chamber of like, I'm going to just listen to people who think exactly the way I do. And they have even more extreme ideas than I do. You know, right. and like the loudest voice wins. And so everybody starts thinking about these awful, awful things. And like, and that's shaping the way we, I don't know, just see everybody else in the entire world. And it's just like, it's so
it's an open platform. Like,
yeah,
you know, anybody can get onto the internet right now and just say anything.
Yeah.
Like, No research, no fact checking. People won't fact check them. People won't use logic or anything. Like you could get somebody and they can just, like you said, the loudest, you know, most ridiculous voice can, you know, can win. Because a lot of times that voice is speaking, even if people, you know, are not outright saying those things, that, you know, you have folks that'll speak to people's subconscious and the mm-hmm. things that they try to hold underneath, you know, them or whatever. It's almost like a lot of us are walking around with like kind of that inhibitor mm-hmm. collar on. What happens, you know, if we actually turn it into a physical thing that could, you know, that if you don't have this to be able to keep you in restraint, what would people really do and say to each other? How would people really treat each other
yeah.
if they didn't have certain inhibitors? And our inhibitors, whether it's, you know, the fear of being ostracized or fear of losing your job or, you know, mm-hmm. all of those are like our, you know, inhibitors to keep a lot of people in pace. It was scary to think about what the world would be like. That's why an apocalyptic world terrifies people, because it breaks down all those conventions.
Yeah.
And all of those things. And like, I mean, people are just kind of feral, you know, for yeah. lack of a better word, to be able to just do and say whatever the hell they want.
Anybody who proudly says that they would thrive in an apocalypse, I don't want to know those people.
You're a bad person.
You are a bad person.
You are waiting for things to crumble down so that way you can tap into, again, those like subconscious things within yeah. you, things that you want to be able to, you know, go out and do things unchecked and to be able to hurt people and yeah. to be able to take from people, because that's, I mean, an apocalypse is all about fighting for resources.
Right.
So, and that's what we were on the brink of in the giggle or whatever. You're on the brink of an apocalypse where people are going to start fighting over resources and fighting over ideas and fighting over space and fighting over everything. Like everybody's just fighting each other.
And that's what makes the toy maker so scary, is because he's doing it just for fun. He's just like, I can do it.
Right, because he just thinks it's funny.
Yeah. I love the sequence where the doctor and Donna go to visit the toy shop where Stooky Bill came from. And then they go into the, you know, they end up in the toy maker's weird kind of evil hallways and stuff like that. And then, you know, Donna gets attacked by marionettes, which are terrifying and everything. The doctor meets the John Logie Baer's assistant who becomes a puppet. And then the doctor himself becomes a puppet. I'm doing a marionette movement for those who can't see me. And then I love the toy maker showing the doctor a marionette kind of show of all the ways since Donna that he's let companions and the universe down. And I thought
that was my favorite scene.
It's such a good scene. And I love the fact that, you know, he's being silly. He's like, you are talking about Amy Pond comes in here. And then every single time he's like, well, no, she's alive. She just went sent back in time. And then he's like, well, that's all right then. It's so good. That's my favorite. Yeah, I think that's,
he's like, the doctor is just like literally has made these, you know, these rationalizations in his mind to be able to cope with, instead of actually coping with and dealing with the fact that, you know, I made some missteps and people got hurt or worse. It's just like, I'm going to tell myself this story. And I'm going to keep telling it to myself until I convince myself that this story is fact and that makes it all right. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, with the toy maker challenging him, well, that's all right then.
Yeah.
It's like, oh.
And he completely drops all accent at that point. It's just, it's just the Neil Patrick Harris voice. And I think that's so perfect. Like, he's just like, all he's doing, he doesn't care. But all he's doing is trying to get a rise out of the doctor so that the doctor will challenge him to a game, because he wants is for the doctor to play this game. And then I love that the doctor picks the easiest game in the world. It's literally high card, knowing that if he wins, hey, that's great, I win. If he loses, he still has another chance because he knows he won the first round. And that's part of the thing.
Right. So he becomes a best out of three.
Yeah. And that Donna's like, you know, he's just going to cheat. And the toy maker is like, how dare you suggest that I would cheat? This is literally the one thing I care about. I love that entire sequence from when they get to the puppet show to, you know, through the game and everything like that. So that is the best, in my opinion, that's like the best.
That's the best part of the episode.
Best part of the episode.
Yeah. Catherine Tate was really like, especially seeing the like myriad of emotions and stuff on Donna's face. She did that really well too. Even, you know, she would kind of say a couple of things to the doctor. She's like, you know, is this true at the end or whatever? But just kind of seeing her look at all the things that are happening now with the knowledge of knowing what happened to her.
Right.
On top of that, because again, that was knowledge that had been locked away from her until recently or whatever. Like the horror, like the fear, the like frustration. You can see a little bit of anger there, like so many emotions flashed across her face during that or whatever. And I was like, wow. Like, I mean, I can't even imagine if you're a companion and you're sitting beside this person that you have a complex history with, that you're trying to fight this like kind of insurmountable battle with right now, somebody that you trust with your life. Like you have left your family behind or whatever. You're trusting this person with your life to not just save you, but to save your daughter and your husband and the whole universe and stuff. And to see that this has happened, you know? Since your time apart, it's like, you know, and also like compassion and understanding and stuff too, of like, wow, like this is why you are the way that you are. Mm-hmm. This is why you're so broken.
Yeah. Like understand, like she goes through the entire range of reactions to that in a scene where she's essentially just being cut to for reaction shots. Like she doesn't have a ton to say.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah. That is why it was so nice to have her back in the show, because she is such a great I mean, she's funny and she, you know, can deliver lines like nobody's business, but she is a great like emoter. She can show the range of those reactions in such a great way. That's, you know, all praise to Catherine Tate, who doesn't need us to say that she's a very good actor, but she is
fantastic. I love her.
Okay. So let's talk about the bi-generation scene. I was like, okay, here we go again. He's going to get shot. Mm-hmm. All this stuff is happening. All I wanted was to him not go out the way he went out as the 10th Doctor, which is he didn't. He's like, you know, he said his what we thought his last words were going to be were, "LNZ, let's go. I think it's great. Good mm-hmm. for you." And then it's not that. And RTD right. gives us a stealth multi-doctor episode that we didn't know we were going to get. And then the two of them against the Toymaker. Although, you know, friend and a podcast cohort of mine on a different show, Eric Stadnick, pointed out that Catch is a pretty boring game.
I was hoping they were going to go for something a little bit more high stakes than that.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Than Catch. But I ultimately, it's like, how do you do a two on one game? You know what I mean? Like, there's very few, yeah. like, brain games that are 2-on-1. Anyway, doesn't matter. What a shock. What a surprise. What a welcome mm-hmm. one. And there's that bit of Shooty saying, "What the hell is going on here?" that was in the trailer way back after The Power of the Doctor.
Yeah.
And he's removed, and it looks like he's just outside or something like that, or like up in the clouds. Right. And I love it when they do stuff like that.
They pulled a good one on us with that. Yeah. I was like, this is great.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Cause they didn't lie. They didn't show us something that wasn't in the episode.
Yeah.
But it was way earlier and a different thing than we expect. And I thought that was really good. What did you think about the way that the Toymaker was defeated? Like, the game itself is whatever, but what did you think about his exile, whatever they decide to call it?
I mean, I guess it was fine. It kind of, you know, there's always that open door of the possibility of coming back. Yeah. And of course, I think more than anything, I really like just that omen that he gave them mm-hmm. at the end of, like, you know, I've got friends and they're coming.
Yeah.
And there's going to be some darkness and stuff coming your way. You know, the mysterious hand picking up the tooth that presumably has the master in it. I mean, that's what I'm assuming yeah. at this point. I think that's what most fans are, you know, assuming. So I like the things that it set up.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, I mean, that was probably the one thing that I was just like, I guess.
Yeah,
you know,
that's where fine. I was at too with it.
It's fun to see Shooty Gatwai, you know, run around without his pants, trying to catch a ball and stuff.
Like, I had to explain to my mom.
What a great introduction there.
My mom was like, "How come he wasn't wearing pants?" And I was like, "Mom, they were each wearing half of the costume." And she was like,
"Right, oh. Yeah." So David didn't have on shoes; he had on the shoes.
Yeah, which I thought was funny. But anyway. Yeah, it was all just in service of getting, because obviously mm-hmm. we know the Toymaker's not going to win, you know? And right. so you kind of need to just dispatch him quickly enough. So I was okay with that.
Yeah.
And
I figured his whole part of his existence would be a setup. I mean, they had been teasing a setup of things to come, even mm-hmm. Beep the Meep was saying, you know, his boss. And I'm like, was his boss really the Toymaker? And is it something, you know, bigger? We have this whole mystery with Jinx Monsoon's character, mm-hmm. you know, coming up in season one. So I'm, you know, assuming that there's a tie-in, you know, some kind of tie-in with that. We don't, you know, we don't really know. It could be somebody completely different. But yeah, that was the part that I enjoyed about it the most, was kind of that omen at the end mm-hmm. and that, you know, that look into what's next.
Yeah, it was,
yeah.
you know, it was just a cool, and it just felt big. It just felt really epic to have,
yeah.
Somebody like a Neil Patrick Harris in the show at all, mm-hmm. but like getting to do all this wild stuff. I just thought it was great. So yeah, I think allowing the doctors to talk to each other mm-hmm. and for the 15th doctor to essentially absolve the 14th doctor.
Oh, I love that.
It was so unexpectedly yeah. nice. And like,
mm-hmm.
cause most of the doctors have some sort of like, you know, sparky kind of like combative, you know, like reaction to each other,
yeah.
which is kind of fun.
But, right. Cause I'm the superior version right. of us.
but this was just him going, you know, it's fine. I am okay. You can mm-hmm. be okay too. And I was just like, wow, I didn't realize.
I love that.
I didn't know
it
I needed that.
It hit me in the feels. Yeah, it hit me in the feels. I mean, it was something that the doctor needed, you know, so bad. Again, like that, this incarnation of the doctor, the 14th doctor, was all about, you know, just having that catharsis.
Yeah.
And being able to, you know, move forward. Because so much of the stuff with the flux and everything was just so heavy, you know, and now the doctor can move forward with a lighter weight on his shoulders yeah. and, you know, and their head held high.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you get to have the 14th Doctor go off and live with Donna and be the weird uncle. Like, I think that's just a really nice thing to do. Also, let's talk about Mel. I forgot to talk about her. Having Mel Bush come back, and if anybody who doesn't know Mel, that's fine. She wasn't in that many episodes. She was the second of two Sixth Doctor companions. Didn't even
you
get
wrote a great explainer about this, by the way.
Yeah,
also on Nerdist. Also on Nerdist.
She didn't get an actual beginning because in the course of that season, they're showing evidence of the Doctor's wrongs from out of order. So. You see an adventure with his next companion before she's actually ever been introduced. So that itself is weird. And then at the end of her first season, only season with the Seventh Doctor, she decides to go off with this weird space pirate just because Bonnie Langford was was and is a pretty busy stage actor. So couldn't really commit to being on a TV show like that forever. So, and then to have her come back and just go, yeah, Kate offered me a job. I came back. I didn't know what to do. I'd been away from Earth for so long. Kate offered me a job. And so here I am, because we had seen her a little bit at the end during the support the
companion
group.
Companion support group.
Yeah. In The Power of the Doctor, which I thought was really fun. But I was just like, man, Mel is great. Like,
she's awesome.
And just knowing that it's very possible that she will be like, if not a main character, possibly a recurring character in the unit show, or at least in Doctor Who or something like that, because we know she's coming back. There's photographic evidence of her and Shooty in character together, so I just love the idea that Kate Stewart, who is herself the daughter of a not companion, the Brigadier was never actually technically a companion, whatever, doesn't matter, an ally of the Doctor, recruiting former Doctor
Who companions
and allies because they know this stuff and like, what do they do best? And like, you know, we saw that in Power of the Doctor as well. Like, Tegan and Ace and Graham were all recruited, you know, like that's cool. Like, I love that stuff.
Yeah. That's so cool.
And so, yeah. So anyway, I'm just really stoked about that. And the idea of going forward, cause you know, if there's going to be spinoffs, I think a unit one makes the most sense because you can do weird for earthy stuff.
and it
could be like a fun and less like trying too hard to be edgy version of Torchwood is what I think.
Yeah,
that's the problem with Torchwood. I would
love a unit spinoff.
Yeah, it would be great.
Plenty of weird stuff happens here, and that gives the main series more time to just go off into the stars. In space. So, I mean, they'll still feel, like have that connective tissue, but they can still feel completely different. But then also have folks in there that we care about.
Yes.
I mean, you have Donna there now. You've got Mel there now, which I knew who Mel was just because I have general Doctor Who knowledge, but I haven't seen a whole lot of the Seventh Doctor or whatever. And so she sparked my interest and certainly has made me want to go back and, and watch some of her stories to get like a better feel, better feel for who she was. But she was brilliant.
Yeah. She's, I think a lot of people from the era, there were a lot of jaded fans in the 80s who were basically like, all she does is scream. And she's just so, she feels very musical theater, which is not, that's what she knew, like the actor. So obviously, but she says stuff like, I'll help anyone if I can, like stuff like that, which is just very chipper, which rubbed people the wrong way, I think, at the time. But who cares? People can just be nice.
This was also 40 years ago, and the way that we, the way that women heroines and stuff are portrayed in TV and film have changed, changed a lot too, or whatever. Because I mean, that was certainly not just the Doctor Who problem back then. I mean, you look back at a lot of things and a lot of the ways that, women leads were depicted on in television and film weren't always the best.
No.
But I mean, so in a way, this is kind of like a redemptive thing for her character too, because that was, that, from what I've seen and my experiences with, classic Who and stuff like that, sometimes you got a couple of women that are leaving to like go be with a dude or being abandoned with a dude or something like that.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, this, kind of, it doesn't necessarily change it or, quote unquote, correct it or anything like that. But I mean, it also gives her a new lease on her and a new spin on her story and gives her story a new ending. Like, that doesn't have to be her ending anymore. Now we know that, okay, she came back to Earth. she found her own life. She found her footing. She's in with Unit now. She's with her people, mm-hmm. and like, you know, found her family and found her place. She has no desire to travel with the Doctor anymore. She knows that that time of her life is, she did it, it's done. And she's kind of like Sarah Jane was, who was happy being on Earth and
yeah.
having her, you know, robot dog and solving, you know, solving cases and adventures and stuff there.
Yeah. I was just thinking of like, Susan, Vicky, Joe, mm-hmm. Leela is one of the most egregious ones ever.
Yes.
technically, Perry, because you find out mm-hmm. that she, didn't actually die in the horrific way that she died, but actually just stayed to live with Brian Blessed's character. Get out of here. Yeah. That would never happen.
Why?
Mel, technically, even though it wasn't like romantic, she did leave the Doctor to go travel with this guy who needed her help, essentially, like, or who needed somebody to look after her.
Right.
That sucks. that's way too many. Joe is an example. That was a good storyline for her, where she was, mm-hmm. she found somebody who had literally had her ethical and kind of environmental mind and was,
right.
and you know, it, that one felt very organic because there were six episodes to lead up to it.
Yeah.
It wasn't like Leela who just goes, I'm going to stay with this guy I think I talked to once here on Gallifrey. Right. It was
poor,
bad.
Poor Susan who just gets left.
Susan's 15 or whatever, how old she's supposed to be.
She's a child.
Left her with a grown man. You were kind of making eyes at this guy. I'm just going to leave you here in this rubble of London after a Dalek attack. Yeah. That was,
and again, she's like, don't leave me.
Yeah.
Let me in.
He's like, no, he's like, I must do this.
Too bad. Yeah. I'm going to give a grand speech to no one because no one else was in the console. Like, <he's> just, I'm going to give this grand speech to myself that you're not really listening to.
Yes.
And leave you behind.
Yeah.
My only family member that I know of at the time.
Right.
Yeah.
I would rather be alone than to be with my granddaughter again. Like, they could have come up with a much better idea for that. That was the problem, is that
nuts.
They almost never knew ahead of time when the companion was going to leave. And so the scripts were already basically written. So they would just have to tag on these little, Joe is right. another, like, that's the main example. Like, they actually gave her time to have like a good ending. The Green Death, if you haven't seen The Green Death, is tremendous. And it's one of the best, Third Doctor stories in general, but it's a really good companion departure, maybe one of the only good companion departures from the classic era. One of, I'd have to do a little think through, but there aren't that many good ones. Anyway, okay, so we simply must talk about The Church on Ruby Road, which introduces Ruby Sunday, played by Millie Gibson, who is just a ball of delightful energy the entire way through. I like the way that Ruby mm-hmm. looks at the world. And of course, you know, with the way she sparks off the 15th Doctor, and there's some stuff that I think is really good involving adoption and just kind of families in general and everything, like what is a family, mm-hmm. all that stuff. Other than that, I think it's fine. I didn't love this one.
Didn't love it. Yeah.
But I
liked
it.
It just brought a lot of good joy. It brought a lot of good joy feels and stuff. The thing I really liked about like Millie and the way she approaches Ruby Sunday is that it made me feel like I was new to the series.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, just because her like wide eye, you know, like wonder and confusion. And even before she knows the Doctor as the Doctor, like when she sees the Doctor wearing his kilt and like spinning around on the dance floor, like she's already just like drawn to this person, like mm-hmm. all these people in the club. And she can't take her eyes off this one specific, you know, one specific person. So it just, her joy is just palpable.
Yeah. And, you know, there's some stuff about it that I didn't really care. The goblin stuff, like, I think that just missed me. Like, I didn't like the song. I didn't care about it at all. I don't understand what they were doing. Mm-hmm. Like, I know what they were physically doing. They were making, but that's not goblins. Those are gremlins. That's, you know, like in gremlins do mischievous stuff like that. Why aren't they gremlins? That's my big thing. There was a whole thing in World War II. Like, if you had just some random tech problem with your plane, it was because the gremlins were at you. And like, why make them goblins? It doesn't make a ton of sense to me. the pirate ship and the vocabulary of rope, like, just so weird. Like,
it was very strange. It was just, I was like, you know what, this is Doctor Who is just not being serious right now. I was like, they're determined. I was like, this is an unserious. And once I just put that in my head, I'm like, this is an unserious episode of Doctor Who.
Yeah.
And once I put that in my head, that this is just unserious and I don't think about it.
Yeah.
Because it's not supposed to make sense. And if you think about it, it's not going to make sense.
Yeah.
And the more you think about it, the more you're just going to be like,
yeah, the less it will make sense. Here? Yeah.
So, yeah. So once I, once I got to that point, I was like, this is fine. I can enjoy this.
This is fine. I like everything's fine.
I love these two characters. I love the whole, you know, link between them being, you know, adopted and stuff. I think Ruby's family, her mom, you know, her adoptive mom and her grandmother and stuff like that are, you know, good supporting characters, people that we'll probably, you know, probably see again or whatever. Like, for the most part, I liked it. The whole mystery with Miss Flood, like, you know, who is she?
Yeah,
what is she doing and
TARDIS,
stuff? Like, yeah. I'm like, what happened between the doctor going back in time to go save baby Ruby and him coming back? Like, what'd she do in that time period? Because when she saw the TARDIS disappear, when she first saw the TARDIS, like, it, she legitimately did not know what it was. She would have had no reason to act, you know, and pretend like she didn't know, because she was arguing with the neighbor about putting it in the street. But I'm like, if she had known what it was at that time, she would have just ignored it, been curious about it, done something else.
Well, she maybe didn't know.
Like, there was no reason for her to. Yeah.
Because what she says at the end is, what's the matter? You never saw a TARDIS before. She doesn't necessarily know that that was that TARDIS. She maybe saw other TARDISes. We don't know. That was something I thought about. The other thing is, when she sees it disappear initially, she drops her bags out of, like, shock.
Yeah, she's shocked.
But what if she's shocked that, oh my God, it's a TARDIS? I haven't seen one of those in 30 years. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm sort of like, I think it's all.
Because I'm like, she called it a phone box, but I'm like, I don't know.
But if she didn't know that was a TARDIS, she's just like, why is this phone box doing here?
Right.
But she could have known that TARDISes exist. She just didn't know that that was a TARDIS. So that's where I'm like, kind of like,
why would you not just assume it's a TARDIS, though? Because
not all TARDISes.
It just
came
up out of nowhere. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know.
Why would you assume it was a TARDIS? What a weird thing to say, Ty.
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, if you know what a TARDIS is already, wouldn't you just assume it was a TARDIS?
But what if you haven't seen it in a really long time? What if you haven't seen a TARDIS in a long time? But now she's like, ah, that's
a TARDIS. Well, she hasn't seen a phone box in a long time either. And that popped up on the street. So if you've seen a TARDIS before, and I haven't, like, phone boxes aren't everywhere. If I've seen a TARDIS before, then it just pops up on the street. I'm like, maybe that's a TARDIS.
I guess that's true. If I see anything I haven't, what's that doing there? Maybe it's a TARDIS. Who left this garbage can? It must be a TARDIS.
She hasn't seen a phone box in a long time either.
Yeah, but those are still things that existed.
But it wasn't on her street. Why would they put one right there?
I don't know.
Well, I mean, I don't know either.
What a silly vein we've gone down. But anyway, that is Mrs. Flood. She is a an interesting character that we will see, hopefully see more of. We will. They wouldn't just do that just for no reason.
There's no way. She's definitely coming back.
Was a big fan of the other Sundays. Cherry Sunday is a great name for the grandma.
She's fantastic.
Was really good. I liked all the stuff with Davina McCall as well. Like, that's not a show that we get over here, though, you know, like, where did I come from or whatever it's called, but like, it's literally a show where she helps people find their birth parents, which is a cool idea. I guess they were not legally allowed to say the name of the show, but it could, like, because of whatever channel it's on or whatever, but they could, Davina McCall could be essentially playing herself hosting that show, like, whatever. So that's, if you didn't know who that was, that's who that is. I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. It was light. It was like you said, it was unserious. There was really fun shooty stuff, and he got to show kind of the depth of his performance, you know, the emotion, like realizing that Ruby had been stolen as a baby and not Lulu Bell was just sort of like, he's like, oh no, like, oh no, this is terrible. And like he's crying, but still being the doctor, which is something that nobody has done before. It's either I am so bereft with emotion or I'm the doctor, whereas he gets to do both at the same time.
Right.
And that just kind of proves what the 15th Doctor is doing. Like, this is the 15th Doctor. He's in touch with himself in terms of how he's mm-hmm. feeling, and that doesn't preclude him from making logical, quote unquote, decisions. I think that was
he's got the space to do that now because of what just happened.
Yeah.
Like he could be that person. He seems so free.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, of course, yes, he's always running into foolish stuff that's happening. And most of the time it's mostly by accident, sometimes by design or whatever, but he just seems so free. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that.
Yeah.
He's in the club. He's hanging out on the streets. He's just like, looks like this kid's got something weird going on with her. Let me just keep my eyeballs there.
Yeah.
See what happens. Next thing you know, he's running on the rooftop or whatever, which is.
Yeah.
I'm like, I didn't realize the Doctor could leap like that.
Yeah. I have a feeling that he's going to be a very physical, mm-hmm. action-y doctor, because he is an athletic dude and can do all that stuff. Which is awesome. Also, and this is your point, I'm stealing your point, but I want you to really reflect on it. The Doctor now has a mustache. Joining only Peter Cushing as the Doctor who has a mustache.
It's one of my favorite things, and I don't know why, but like the Doctor having a mustache and just like wearing a shirt, like partially like unzipped and open and stuff. And he's just giving off like 70s, like giving me like Billy Dee Williams vibes. And I really love that for all of us, which we've all won because the Doctor has a mustache now.
Yeah, it's true.
We are winning.
We get to see, him in the 60s looking rad too, like, because there's a Beatles episode.
Oh my gosh, the Beatles episode. I'm so excited about that.
Yeah. So
use the TARDIS closet. Like I'm so excited that he's going to be doing not just him, but Ruby is mm-hmm. also really getting in on the act too. She feels like if you take some of the best aspects of Rose and Clara and kind of mix those together.
Yeah, that's a good, like that. I like that because she's more, I guess, hard to say for a 19-year-old, but she's more worldly. It feels like she kind of gets the world a lot better than Rose did. Rose was emotionally and was intelligent, but just didn't know, like hadn't been around.
She wasn't very mature.
Right.
Yeah.
Ruby has to be because of that's just how her life has been and how people nowadays and just are more mature than they used to be because the world is mm-hmm. terrible. So yeah, I think that's a really good shout. Like, I think that completely makes sense to me because I was trying to think, because it's not just Rose. Like, she's not just the same character again, which is important.
Right.
Like, but she's like,
and that was an assumption that a lot of people made, you know, just from even before. And I mean, you know, it's unfortunate that people were making those assumptions just from looking at photos because she's young and she's, you know, blonde and mm-hmm. everything like that. So a lot of people assume, okay, she's going to be like a Rose 2.0 and, mm-hmm. you know, all of those things. But I just don't, you know, I don't see that at all. I think she has a lot of Rose's, like, Rose always had a lot of like grit and she kind of had like some of that like natural curiosity and, you know, and wonder about the world mm-hmm. around her and kind of like that like sense of like wanderlust of like, I want to be doing something more. I want to explore something more. I feel like there's something bigger, you know, bigger out there. And there are questions out there that I want answers to. And like Ruby has that not only in her personal life, because now there's this whole mystery with her family and why can't they find things about what's going on with her mom? And, you know, now she meets this mysterious person who's a time traveler who has this, you know, awesome machine. So she's searching for like questions on like a nuclear level, but then she's also looking for like, you know, new universal truths and stuff too.
Yeah. And she's so excited when she kind of goes like, what is he? I have to find it out.
Right. I have to find this out.
And she gets to do the thing that Rose did, which is cool, which is you go in the TARDIS, then you come out and then you walk around it. Like the bigger on the inside bit. Like,
yeah. Millie said that was her favorite scene in the film.
I bet.
From the Christmas special. Because she was like, I just wanted to think about, she was like, I just kind of like transported myself into her space. And I was like, I just wanted to think about, you know, how would I feel if a whole new aspect of like living in reality and stuff was just like unlocked to me, like in a snapshot. So she was like, I just wanted to make sure that I got that. She was like, you know, I didn't have a lot of time to film it. Because, and you could tell from the scene too, that the sun's getting ready to go down.
Oh, for
so
sure.
They're losing daylight.
Yeah.
They had been, she said that filming had been really long that day and they were running out of time and stuff. And so she was like, I just knew I had to like nail that wonder and like nail it quickly. And she was like, and I got into that mode and just, you know, it just hit it immediately. Yeah. And like her eyes, she's such a delight.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to it. Season one, we can call it season one. That's what it's called. Will premiere sometime in May, Russell T. Davis said. So there'll be eight episodes, and then they're already filming, or maybe even almost done filming, season two.
The Christmas special. And the Christmas special. They're working on Christmas special already for 2024, which is wild.
It's rad. So what? That's another part. Like, Disney needs them scripts in much earlier than the BBC did. They want to know what's going on. And so part of me thinks, you know, because in the past, when Doctor Who has been a springtime show, it has been like March, April. This is later than that, obviously. But I think that is down to Disney being like, don't, you know, conflict with any of our other stuff, which is reasonable. You want it to stand on its own, which I think is good. So I'm looking forward to it. May does seem like a really long way away, though, but whatever. My birthday is in May, so it'll be a fun
I think it's because we just got like this like nice smattering of things after a while. We're always trying to get some stuffs because sometimes we have to wait too long.
Yeah, very true. We had to wait an entire year from The Power of the Doctor until the 60th specials. That's the way time works. But those were way done, or almost entirely done. Definitely all shot. Right. So anyway, Ty, literally I could talk to you about Doctor Who for hours, and we have, but thank you for joining me as for my first guest of 2024. Long may you return, because I'm sure we'll have other things to talk about at some point. How could people get
taking
a hold
things off in style?
Are you still on the social medias, and do you still want people to find you there?
I am still on the social medias, and sure, I guess you can find me there. I'm not doing a whole lot. Yeah. Sometimes I'm complaining over there, or I'm just posting food. I post a lot about food on Instagram. That's the best place to find me is Writer Ty Gooden. And I post stories about food, and I post quotes. And now that I'm on like a vegetarian, pescatarian kind of journey.
Nice. Good.
I'll probably just be sharing those types of things or whatever, but and then sometimes I do still haunt the halls of Twitter/X, but I'll usually just be posting about Doctor Who stuff over there. I'll be there more. Right now, I'm going to probably go dark on there for a while because there's nothing to talk about until The Walking Dead returns next month.
Yes. So even though there's not going to be a ton of movies this year in our space, not zero, but definitely not as many, there will be a lot of good TV coming out. So that's good. And so, yeah, we have The Walking Dead coming up. We have Doctor Who in May. We also have, I think, is it going to be this year? Might be 2025 because of the strike, but Star Trek Strange New Worlds is coming back for season 3.
Yeah.
Good stuff. Good stuff on the horizon. Echo, as you good listen stuff. To this, will be just a few days from now. So good stuff indeed. If you want to get a hold of me, I am not on X. I got off before it was called X. So I win. But you can follow me on Instagram at functional_nerd, which used to be my old Twitter handle. I post mostly stuff about movies and cats, because my life is cats for the most part. And you can follow me on Letterboxd. You see what you can see my entire ranking of all the 2023 movies that I saw, from favorite to least favorite. It's about 60 movies, which isn't a lot for a lot of people, but it's a lot for me of new releases. So follow me on Letterboxd at Kyle_Anderson. Get ready for more Doctor Who content. We are going to ramp up. You can follow things we write, Nerdist.com, or watch our videos, YouTube.com/Nerdist. Okay, I think that's everything. Thank you all for listening. I've been Kyle Anderson. Join me again on Laser Focus next week, when my guest will be a different person. Bye-bye.
Laser Focus is a production of Nerdist Industries and Legendary Digital Networks. It was produced, edited, and hosted by me, Kyle Anderson. For more, visit Nerdist.com.